Good evening to everyone. Nice to see you again. So I have a title for tonight's talk. What's it all for? That's the title. Based on, I guess, a conversation that Gina and I had yesterday. We were talking about what's it all for, and she was saying to me, I hope you don't mind that I repeat this, I found it kind of inspiring that sometimes she asks herself this question, what's it all for? Sometimes we experience loss, for example, and you wonder, you know, because everything is impermanent and changing, what's it all for? What's this all for? Sometimes you come home from work in the evenings and you're working 9 to 5 every day and you get home and you're exhausted and you think, you know, what's it all for? Or, Gina was saying sometimes you look at in nature and there's this incredible beauty and you also wonder, what's this all for? And I thought it was a very deep question. And I actually realized in my own way, I sometimes ask this question and I wonder if all you haven't also asked this question, but it seems very essential. And I thought about it for a while. And last night after the talk, you know, I never quite exactly know what I'm going to speak on, but I feel very much shaped by the people I meet in a place or talk to, like with Gina and all of you. And last night after the talk, we had the questions and responses, and I felt I started to think about how I could extend our interaction tonight. And I thought about it, and I wanted somehow to address this or respond or bring this up. And I was thinking for myself, what's it all for? There is something that it's all for, and that is I feel it can be. It depends on you. It can be to wake up. It's all for waking up. So I want to talk about that tonight. It's all to utilize to wake up. This experience that we have in life, all of our experiences. And I've thought about this quite a bit. I always think that life is just this stream of momentary experiences that we have. That's what life is, isn't it? And if these experiences don't, like we talked about, touch us or change us, then what is it for? What is it for? So it makes me think that actually this is something very useful, this life arising, these momentary experiences that we have are something that we often don't value or appreciate, and actually we struggle with our experience so much. There's a lot of wants and not wants throughout the day, you know, excitement when something comes our way and agitation and despondency when things don't happen the way we wish for them to happen. I feel for myself, it was interesting, somebody wrote into my blog the other day, they said, you know, some teachers say that true practitioners are as rare as daytime stars. You know, we've all heard this one. He says, but then what are all we Buddhist bozos doing? He was asking. I was thinking, it's good to kind of think about this. You know, why are we doing this? And I was thinking, well, I think, you know, I had to think for myself, well, why do I practice? Why do I practice? Why is it important to me? What does it do for me? And it has a lot to do with valuing and utilizing experience. So I want to talk about that tonight, this process of valuing experiences, even challenging things like great loss. How do we utilize that? You know, how do we move on? And how do these experiences touch us and benefit us? Because in a way, it's really up to us, you know, what we do with our life and our experience. It's not like it has some intrinsic value. The value is up to how we experience it and utilize it. And I do think that this has been a question for all the great practitioners of the past. And I brought a poem from one of my great heroines, I'm sure you would agree, Yeshe Sojo, the great yogini practitioner, expresses a lot of value about experience. You know, a lot of times we think for practitioners, you know, they leave and they go off into a cave and they don't value these experiences. But in actuality, I think that the yogis and yoginis that we hear about in the Vajrayana are very, very interested in experience. Not distraction, but their own experience. They want to look at it, they want to fall apart, like we talked about last night. They're interested in using it, and in many cases, they invite experience. So I think I remember in Ellsworth, I read a piece of this poem, and I just felt inspired to read the whole thing. It's not too long, it's just this long. And this is a very Vajrayana kind of poem, but I'm just reading it so we could get a hit of the spirit of our tradition. It's not just Yeshe Sojo, but, you know, all the great practitioners, you know, Thilo, Naro, the whole line. So I'm just going to read it and just let it kind of seep in and just kind of speaks of the spirit that I'm talking about. It says, Emaho, which means how amazing. The Dharmakaya, wisdom of the Great Mother, essence of the Ten Perfections, practice of deep wisdom, there are now fulfilled. No appearance now will frighten me. All arises as the play of Dharmakaya. The phantoms are but the compassion of my teacher. I pray that he may send me more and more. Emaho. Wisdom of Samantabhadra, essence of view, meditation, and the fruit, the practice of not meddling with arising thoughts. These I have perfected. Thoughts and concepts hold no fear for me. Whatever comes is but the play of thoughts. These thoughts are the compassion of my teacher. I pray that he might send me more and more. Emaho. The wisdom of the Lotus Guru, the essence of the all-pervading Achi, the practice of the stainless mind, these I have perfected. Concepts of defilement do not come to me. Defilements are the play of ultimate reality. All that I perceive is merely the compassion of my teacher. I pray that he may send me more and more. Emaho. Observance of the woman's sojo, the essence of the secret mantra, the practice of equality of joy and sorrow. These I have perfected. I do not choose between the good and bad, for both bring progress to my meditation. All appearance is compassion of my teacher. I pray that he might send me more and more. So I guess when we say this is the compassion of my teacher, you know, in the Vajrayana they say, see everything as the guru, it means that everything can be utilized for awakening. And I guess that's what I wanted to share. And she's saying, bring it on. She had this kind of spirit, and she couldn't wait to get onto the mountaintop and take off her clothes in the snow and sit there and then sing this song after she went through tremendous, you know, her sores broke out on her body and they got infected, and, you know, she had so many experiences, but she had a deep, deep interest in experience. Deep interest, not just in feeling good, not just in being distracted, not at all, actually, but understanding her mind and appreciating everything that happened to her. So I just wanted to read that because it really holds the spirit, I guess, of what I wanted to talk about tonight. And always great to hear from an important heroine of our tradition, too. You know, in some sense, I feel like we live in a world that's very different than the world she lived in. And I don't really think we have to live on a mountaintop and invite difficulties. We have plenty to work with in our own daily life. We live in a very kind of intense and rich period of time, exciting and all kinds of things at once. And so we do have what we need to work with. But this attitude of welcoming our experience and our life in this way is very, very important, I think, for us to understand as practitioners. So then the thought might come, or the question might come to our mind, Well, how do we utilize the experience then? How do we utilize it? How do we practice this? How do we take it in and make and develop from our experience? And tonight I thought to speak of a particular practice, but it doesn't really matter what practice it is, because actually this is important for all practices. But I wanted to talk about Tonglen, and I might be speaking about it in a slightly different way, with the focus of this idea of valuing experience, because it's a very powerful practice. I think it's an extremely advanced practice, actually, and I'll say more about that. But it is the practice of inviting things that we usually avoid, which is a very radical, as Eric and I, we were all talking last night, it's a very radical. Buddhism, Buddhist practices are all quite radical, and this one is extremely radical and amazing and rebellious. You know, if you have a rebellious streak in you, you'll love this practice, as you probably already know much about it. So Tonglen kind of changes the attitude we have about experience. So instead of pushing away, like I was saying, suffering, we value it as an antidote to clinging, self-clinging, which is the cause of tremendous pain in us. And instead of keeping what we like for others, we offer it to them instead. And I think probably most of you have done some Tonglen. Is it true? Yeah. So that's good. And we will talk about that a little bit more. But really, if you think about practice, it has to do with experience, how we relate to our experience. If we didn't have experience, we wouldn't need to think about practice. We have some trouble relating to our experience. Therefore, we're trying to find a way to work with that. Therefore, we're practicing. So practice has to do with how we assimilate or digest experience. For ourselves, make use of it. So how do we digest this stream of thoughts and emotions and sensations, physical sensations and feelings and so forth? How do we digest our life, really? How do we digest our life is a question. And I've often used the analogy in my book, I mean, if you've read that piece, I've used the analogy of digesting food, eating, and digesting, ingesting, processing, and eliminating food. It's a good way to talk about, actually, experience, I've found. We eat food, we ingest food, and we get that kind of fuels us, and then we have to the energy of the food is distributed throughout our body, and then we eliminate what we don't need. And it's very energy efficient. And I think practice is about being energy efficient. If we're struggling and we're avoiding and we don't have a sane relationship with our experience, if we have what we talked about last night, this sense of being aggressive to the natural energy, the natural vitality, the rich energy of our experience, it exhausts us. We don't have our full energy. I know when I've looked at my teachers, especially Dilgo Khenzo Rinpoche, one of my main teachers, he just seemed to never sleep. He slept very little, and sometimes he'd be teaching and he'd sleep for a few moments, and he'd come back and he'd just continue whatever he had been saying, 2 minutes ago. But incredible, boundless energy, because there's not that kind of struggle happening in him. It's all energy efficient, he's using his resources well, So for us, this is the same with digestion, and similar is a good analogy for practice, because it's very much the same thing. How do we put this food or this life experience, how do we put it to use? Sometimes I feel it's very odd or interesting that as human beings, it doesn't come very naturally to us. Like eating, it just happens. It's kind of natural. Sometimes we have troubles with it, of course. But how we digest experience, how we take it in, how we process it, and how we eliminate it is not really so natural to us in general. And this is why we need a practice, I think, for just this very reason. So I want to talk about ingesting first. And I feel like last night I talked a lot about ingesting. So I was talking about let life touch you. That's like letting life in or ingesting your food in some way. I told you about that practice where we crossed over the line. That was kind of a way of ingesting. We have a willingness to look at something. We have a willingness to maybe let something touch us a little bit, you know, and change us a little bit. So that's, again, it's like eating. I was telling, I think it was David, we were talking today. Sometimes we're very harsh with ourselves and our experience. And I had this, another Sokhne Rinpoche, I like Sokhne Rinpoche's teachings. He was saying, you know, sometimes we don't want to let things into our experience. And he was giving this talk, and he was talking about how hardened we get in a way, how we refuse our food, you know. So he takes this thing, he's a dad, you know, and he holds this blanket like this, and he says, this is how you should talk to your kind of experience in your mind when you're feeling that way. He says, honey, honey, you know, kind of like, and it was so funny because I actually kind of talk to myself that way when I feel like it's too hard to take it in. I just say, sweetheart, you know, kind of to myself, like your mother's talking to you or something. Like there has to be this sense of softness. If you're not porous, it doesn't come in. So there's porousness is necessary for this process. And it's so liberating, too, because the hardness, it's like we've talked about, it's the hardness and this kind of resistance to the experience is actually the painful quality that we experience. I heard Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, just lean into it a little bit. Just lean into it a little bit. You know, stop resisting it. Stop resisting your life, your experience. So there's that ingesting. We have an obstacle ingesting. That's one of them. We have two, I think. So the first one is that we resist. We resist a lot. And that, in some ways, to me, seems like when I work with people in retreat, this is the most painful and prominent obstacle, is the resistance to experience. Wishing you were someone else, somewhere else, having a different experience. That's really very, very strong. And I've seen it quite a bit in myself. And then the second thing that happens, trouble we have with ingesting experience, is that sometimes we overeat, I guess you can say. We get lost in the momentum of our emotions. So like last night we were talking about, you cross over the line, but there's always this danger, then you get sucked into your story. So when we practice, we also get sucked into our beliefs and our story, you know, our drama, or the thoughts that we have, they arise, and we believe them. We believe them, even though there's nothing truthful about them. They're just a thought, and they're passing, and they're impermanent, and yet they have a very strong hold on us. So we believe our thoughts. And another interesting thing that happens with our thoughts and our emotions is that we want to get... One way we try to get rid of them, actually, is to try to vent them. Do you know what I mean? It's like it seems like venting is healthy because it feels like you're not suppressing. But in a certain way, I think when we vent, it's just another way of not being there and bearing witness to our experience. So there's this kind of, we're talking about digestion, so excuse me, this vomitous kind of reaction that we have toward our experience, that we feel like we just have to almost throw it off or get it out or express it. And not saying that's always so bad to express yourself, but it's not practice. You know, we were saying yesterday, you know, you have to decide whether you're in love with the practice or you're in love with your own story. You know, and this is just a process. Of course, we're going to continue to vomit a little bit and continue to resist our food or whatever. But you know, we're finding that place. You know, we're finding that place in the, I don't want to say in the middle, because it's not like 50% of this and 50% of that, or a balance of anything. It's beyond. It's just a whole other way of being with our experience, where we value and appreciate it deeply and use it in a certain kind of way. So sometimes, again, we don't know what to do with the energy of our experience. So there's the resisting, and there's the venting, or the kind of getting lost in the story part of it. But either way, we don't get nourished. That's the point. Either way, the food doesn't, we don't process it, it doesn't get distributed throughout the body, we don't get our full energy from it, we're not utilizing it. So it's very similar with the practice, it's the same with the experience, you know. So then we have the processing of our experience. So say we do ingest it. When I talk about processing, I'm not talking about psychological processing where you're kind of tracing everything to its source and trying to figure out what it means. But I don't mean to say here that sometimes that's very important. Sometimes we were speaking this morning about trauma. Gina, Erica, and I were speaking about trauma, and sometimes just to even look and say it happened is difficult, and you need to kind of trace it. So I don't want to make this sound like this is not sometimes a necessary step in the process of becoming sane and healthy, you know, with your mind. But right now, I think in the context of this, I think processing maybe means just learning from life, letting it teach you something, letting it, again, touch you and really change you. You know, that's what learning does. It changes you. Being able to utilize it and fall apart. When we eat, you know, our cells get nourished. It destroys all the some pathogens in our body, hopefully. It builds antibodies. Our hair grows. Our skin cells, you know, rejuvenate, and our nails and all this great stuff. This is continuously happening to us. So we could take in our experience and just let it work on us. Let it change us. You know, let this experience change us. This is the purpose of practice if we value it. So then the third point is elimination. And this is very important. If we don't eliminate, the body's going to hold on to what it doesn't need, which just makes us toxic, the body toxic. And I think if you look at this in the context of practice, you know, we talked about holding on to beliefs, all kinds of beliefs we have about ourselves, who we are, and like you were saying last night, some of these are completely unconscious. It's so pervasive. It's just our relationship to our life and our world, in this sense of realness about things and this fear that things go away, because when they're real, then they go away. All kinds of beliefs that pervade our life. So we have these beliefs. We need to continuously let the beliefs, like the cells have to change and things have to die in order for new things to happen. We are dynamic as human beings, where everything is dynamic. So the falling away process is obviously necessary for that to happen, to be healthy. If we block the energy flow, then we can't be healthy. Our bodies can't be healthy. Or if we block the energy flow emotionally or in any way with our experience, then of course it can't move. We can't regenerate. You know, we talked again about the aggression to the natural vitality of the mind, resisting this, the rich energy of our life. This is the falling apart part that I'm talking about with the elimination, that eventually then you have to continuously fall apart, and the process then happens, you know, continuously. This falling apart thing sometimes feels scary. It can feel frightening the way we think about it, but there's nothing really more scary than holding on to something that changes. You know, that's really the definition of samsara in a certain way. The world is changing and dynamic and fluid, and we hold on to something as static. So this is a good definition of pain or samsara, I think. You know, we talked last night too about the story of Gotami and her child. You know, when she was able to put down the child, that's kind of an elimination, not an elimination of the love or the care for the child. Well, it's all of those things actually, because it's letting the situation as it happened touch her and move her, letting it teach her something, and then her being able to let go of her beliefs and her clinging. and she needed to do this in order to move on. That story is so useful for so many things. Such an incredible example. I feel I always, each time, it almost is so poignant, just as poignant to talk about or think about as the last time. So again, there's so many practices on the path, but they all have to do something to do with digesting experience, in the spirit of utilizing everything. Again, you know, take it in, let it touch you, and let the beliefs fall away is like ingesting, processing, and eliminating experience, food and experience. So I just want to talk a little bit about the practice itself. But first, the taking in part. Is what Tonglen means, taking in and giving. Taking in and giving. And it rides on the breath, inhaling and exhaling. So I want to talk about taking first. Again, the purpose of the practice is to take in what we resist. Like I said yesterday, it reverses the sense of aggression. You know, it's a practice of nonviolence. And the technique is, again, to breathe in everything that we usually push away. So all the kind of fears that we have, the kind of revulsion or repulsion we have toward things, things that are scary to us, suffering. And this can be actually our own or others. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We breathe in the suffering. We breathe in, often the emphasis is very much on others. So we bring in their pain, like we discussed last night. And it can be very specific or very kind of general. Sometimes it's really helpful to think of something specific. Oftentimes, like for some people, like an animal suffering is very poignant. So you're kind of rousing. It was interesting this morning because Eric was saying at the breakfast table how some people feel, oh, they don't understand all this suffering business. They don't feel the suffering, which can be a really huge obstacle, you know. And sometimes just when we're sitting, we don't feel a lot of pain. We feel a little dull or distracted. So it's good to arouse some compassion. There's tremendous suffering in the world, and we see this around us. And sometimes it's good to recall that in a very specific way so that this is not also abstract. If it's abstract, then it won't touch you. And this practice is not going to work if you don't let something touch you. You know, you need to bear witness to suffering and breathe it in. That's what you have to do with this practice. So you can visualize, for me, animals oftentimes are something I visualize. There's this one black dog that's locked in this tiny cage in Crestone, and Ani Pema and I have a thing about it. Pema Trudon, you know, she stays in retreat with us often, and we're always talking. Whenever we are thinking about compassion or rousing compassion, we often think of this black dog because he seems so sad in that cage. Anything that touches you personally, that you feel like you wish you could take the pain away. You wish you could take the pain away. So you breathe in that image. But sometimes it doesn't need to be that specific. Sometimes you just breathe in the heaviness. Just this heaviness that you feel, this kind of despair, which is not just your despair, but there's just despair in the world, you know, and we don't want to experience it. But you breathe it in and you value it, because this is the antidote. And we'll talk more about how it's the antidote. But it's completely working against your own aversion, your own aggression to your mind. Because this is actually part of the natural vitality of the mind. This is a Mahayana practice, but to me this is a Vajrayana practice, I always feel. Because a Vajrayana practice has to do with valuing. It's like, what is the nature of the five negative emotions? Oh, mirror-like wisdom, you know, the all-pervasive wisdom and so forth, you know. So it really is valuing something that we're accustomed to pushing away. You know, and this reverses our habitual clinging and opens us up. And I'll say more, but So there are there's some couple interesting pitfalls that I've noticed just talking to people or noticing myself about breathing in, taking. One of them is, again, to think, oh, it's their pain. I'm taking in their pain. And again, we are intentionally taking in the pain of others or the dog. But there's a way to kind of keep that whole situation at bay and not let it touch you when you think of it as their pain. And actually, like I was saying to someone who was sitting over there last night, maybe she's not here tonight, but whenever we feel pain at looking at someone else's situation, of course it's our pain, you know. Pain and compassion are interesting because actually if we were able to relate very samely to other people's pain, what we actually feel is compassion, not pain. Compassion, that where there's no clinging. But in pain, even when it's others' pain, we have our own clinging, our own, because we have aversion to pain in the first place. So I think this is important because a lot of people feel they're doing Tonglen for others, which we are. We would love to take away people's pain. You know, much of the time when we're doing this practice, we wish we could take away others' pain. But that's not just what this practice is. This practice is reversing an aversion to pain and trying to understand pain and suffering in a bigger way, to be able to include life, not just what we want, to be inclusive and expansive. You know, they say, Shanti Deva says, you know, usually we have all this love and care for ourselves, you know, and we're just trying to maintain that. But the whole point of bodhicitta is to include others in this love and care so they can also be the recipients of our love and care. So it's really just an expanding of experience. It's an inclusion. An inclusion of others and an inclusion of our own. Because we're actually always pushing away our own experiences. You know, how we see others and our relationship to others is very much our own projection and our own kind of phenomena that we experience. So that's one thing. So you can't really bear witness to anything, other people's pain or your own pain, unless you let it touch you. So to say, oh, it's their pain and I'm taking in their pain, is a way to kind of not really take it in. We can do this without taking it in. This is, I think, important information. And the other thing, the other extreme, again, is just getting lost and overwhelmed by pain, which is a problem that a lot of people have. Again, it means we're not digesting it well, that we're not able to really let it in. There's some clinging, there's some aversion there. We don't want to let it touch us so much. So this is another thing that kind of indicates that our practice is off. Our Tonglen practice, the aspect of the breathing in part, is a little bit off. So, you know, how you can really tell, again, that the breathing in is working is that you feel more compassion and this kind of aversion and suffering, this tightness disappears. Or like what Rinpoche said, you know, there's this, the dagger in your heart dissolves. It's like a dagger. This clinging is very painful. Suffering is very painful. So it's quite interesting because it makes you question things. You know, what is suffering before we try to subjugate it or put a lid on it or embellish it or make something out of it? It starts asking this question. It's a very profound question, kind of a question that leads to emptiness. We have beliefs about suffering, very strong beliefs, you know, or else we wouldn't continuously fight it. Maybe there's something more to it than meets the eye. And so to just at least give it the benefit of a doubt, and think that maybe this could be of value, is tremendous. This is the practitioner's attitude. So that's about inhaling. Now I want to say something about exhaling or giving. So of course when we give, we breathe something good out, something we cherish, or what we usually cherish for ourselves or want for ourselves, we breathe it out into the atmosphere for others. And Again, it can be very specific. For example, you see someone who looks very lonely and you wish to give them some companionship. You know, that's a big, that comes up for me a lot. I wish for them to have some companionship or some food or warm clothes or just a peaceful state of mind, or, well, you know how it is. You know, you see people and you wish you could change something for them. So that's more the specific. You know, you wish you could let that dog out of that cage. We wanted to, but he has a gun, this guy. We're scared. He's kind of a very, kind of a little bit aggressive man. So we want to let the dog out. At least we have this strong intention. And I feel this is a very, somehow for me, I feel, you know, when we have a negative attitude, it changes our environment. So why wouldn't a positive attitude, a loving attitude, change our environment as well? So I have a strong faith in this, just practice, and we just keep, you do keep doing it, and you keep caring, you know. So then that's the more specific way, but the atmospheric or the more general way is, again, to breathe out a lightness or wakefulness of being, or just this feeling of freedom, or, you know, however you experience that. You know, this is a practice you can be incredibly creative with, and you just do what works. If you need to get, if it gets abstract and you need to be more specific, you do that. You might find yourself just resting in a very peaceful place. Just breathe that out, you know. We're changing in the dynamics. Whatever, with practice, whatever works, be creative, you know, with that. So this cleanses, this breathing out cleanses everything we hold on to, so we don't turn toxic. You know, we don't, holding on is toxic, is what this is saying. And I remember, if you've read my book, I think the story is in there, but still, I think it's a great help in this practice. And it reminds me of Bill and Jane back there. The lottery, the story. Because I'll just briefly tell this story, and I have more to expand on it this time. So many years ago, I had to pick my brother up in Santa Fe, which is like 3.5 hours from my house. And on the way home, I stopped, and the lottery was up to like $75 million or something. And I thought, I'm going to get a ticket. Why not? You know. And so then I had three more hours or so to go. And the whole way, I just thought about what I could do with this $75 million. And for whatever reason, which I'm very happy to have seen, I didn't even think about buying a pair of jeans for myself. I just thought about other people and beings. This was maybe a sign that maybe I've been doing a little bit of bodhicitta. The little bit of bodhicitta that I have has taken some kind of birth in me somehow. And I spent 3 hours. I got so creative. I was in Africa and India, and, you know, animals were being freed, and, you know, people were getting houses, and, you know, it just was, and then specific things like how I would support my friends who are starving artists, and how I could pay people in my sangha to do dharma work, and say that they could do more and quit their jobs, and I mean, it went on and on, and it was like this incredible fantasy. Incredible fantasy. And then I got to Santa Fe, and I was so full of joy, truly full of joy. And I couldn't, why was I full of joy? And then I realized, oh, because for 3 hours I've been thinking about giving to others. And so that was nice. And so then when I went to Ellsworth two years ago or so, God, it just seems a while ago. Yeah, I guess last year I went to that's right. And somebody gave me a lottery ticket as a gift, a Maine lottery ticket. So I don't even know if I'm eligible, but then I could have given it to you guys, because I think you have to be from that state. But anyways, so we're all having dinner together. Peter, were you there? No, you just missed it or something. Yeah. So we put the lottery ticket in the middle of the table, and we just started to eat dinner and drink our wine or whatever we were doing, and we started going. And we did we had our fantasy, like, as a group. It was really fantastic. It was a great dinner, you know. We had just so much energy and so much, I really remember that very vividly. And then, of course, we were sure we were going to win. And in the morning, first thing we checked, but not this time, not yet. So anyways, this is the what we can think about when we're doing the giving. It's really fun and joyful practice. It's somehow the lottery idea of it brings it out of an abstraction and makes it, it's like you have the money and you have a certain amount, and what would you do? You know, it kind of helps the practice a little bit. Anyways, I was telling Peter the other day in the car, because we were sharing, we like documentaries, so we were sharing what documentaries we like. And I did see an interesting HBO documentary in October called Lottery. And it followed five different people who had won the lottery. It was the most outrageous and, like, shocking thing, because everyone was miserable. I couldn't believe it. Okay, there, I'll tell you what happened. Okay, there's one guy, I think he was a little bit, I don't know, but he moved into a seedy hotel. This is what he did. He won millions and millions. He moved into a seedy hotel, and he just fed stray cats, like, all the time. He was so uncomfortable with his money. I mean, I think there might have been something a little off about him anyways. But anyways, then there was two people who lived in one town, and they won all this money. And then all of a sudden, they couldn't relate to their friends anymore. They like there was like this disconnect. And they felt very isolated. They felt people didn't like them or felt uncomfortable. They felt like everybody wanted something from them. So they had to move out of their town. And then they go to show you, oh, they have a five-car garage. But they've lost all their friends. And she didn't have a livelihood. She didn't have to work anymore. So that kind of connection to her community was missing. They did. It wasn't a happy situation. It didn't feel joyful, I would say. They complained a lot. And then, let's see what else. There was one man whose son attempted to kill him for the, I guess, the insurance or whatever. So someone was kind of after him. And this was a documentary. It was a true thing. So he was like, there's all this aggression from his family around this money, and he had refused to give them any of it. That's why. Imagine your father, you know, winning all, and then you don't give. But anyways, that was very sticky. and then there was this one man, I think, he just looked lost and confused. He was a little bit more, I guess, intact, but he just looked very lost and confused throughout the whole movie and unhappy. And then there was one man, he was a little better. It was a little tiny Vietnamese man. And he bought a mansion, a huge mansion, and he invited his entire family from Vietnam, like 50 people, to live in this mansion, and all they did was cook and eat and laugh all day. So that was kind of, on one hand, it was so sweet and generous to his family, but it looked, to me, it's like, cook and eat and laugh all day with tons of people in your house? I don't know. It was hard for me to relate. But he was the best off because he was generous to at least his people. To his people. So he didn't look miserable, but it looked like a very insulated, kind of a stat, something a little bit, it didn't look juicy to me. Eating all day, you know, I don't know. Anyways, so I just find this very interesting, you know, that money can create a lot of pain in this way. You know, richness can be painful if you hold on to it, I guess is my point. And it can be so liberating. I'd rather not have $75,000 million if that's what it does, you know. What I learned from this movie is like, if you get it, give it away as fast as you can, because it didn't look, or maybe one would have the maturity to understand it a little bit better and be able to, I know in Kong from my teacher's book, he has a whole chapter on something about wealth. I can't remember. I edited the book. Something about your natural inheritance and how rich we all are, and how it takes one kind of merit to gather riches, but it takes a whole other kind to be able to appreciate it. Remember that? Yeah. It's a beautiful, Because it's true, we have all this richness, but we don't know how to appreciate it. And the same goes for our experience. You know, we have all this experience, but we don't know how to value it. So this practice is showing us how to value it. You breathe in what you don't, and you breathe out what you cherish. And this is how you value richness. Very radical, yeah? So to be able to see richness of life this way changes the atmosphere of mind in our relationships and everything around us so much. I want to say, I kind of want to make a little praise for this practice. Praise. This practice is very important for me. And even if when I don't do it in a formal way, it's the attitude of the practice, I think, that I take with me off the cushion. It's like I, you know, experience a deep loss. But I never feel like it shouldn't have happened. Maybe I'll say it out loud. I had a loss a couple of weeks ago. I lost my horse. And she was very precious to me. This was only maybe 2 weeks ago or less. Very, very dear to me. We were kind of like this. And I've been watching myself and how I've been very heartbroken about it. But then I see that it's not like I wish it didn't happen. It's like I'm looking for a way to understand myself better and to make her, she's still valuable to me because I'm still learning from her. And her even passing away was very deeply moving for many people. I wasn't there. And all my friends from the stable gathered around, and one of the young girls held her head while she was dying and sang to her, and they made a shrine for her. And it was like so much love came out of people and so much care came out of people. It was very moving to me. And this is all precious. It's so valuable. You know, what is the duration of life, you know, compared to, I felt lucky to have known her, you know. So even loss, it's pretty good I can say that without crying at this point, because for a few days there I didn't ever think I was going to be able to talk much about it. But, you know, even this sense of loss is valuable. Everything is valuable. There isn't anything that isn't valuable if we have this attitude. If we have this attitude, it would be strange for me to wish that she hadn't died. There's something not quite right about that. That it happened. And so now what? You know? And I feel like I can honor her better if I appreciate her and feel the heartbreak of it and always love her, you know, still. So like I'm saying, this practice is very important to me because I can bring it out in that way into my life, you know, bring it into my life in that way. And the thing that I found most amazing about it is that all these things that we usually push away sometimes are really of the greatest value to us. This is what you find of the greatest value to us. And it's interesting because it's not so much that suffering is good, so you should breathe it in. What's powerful about this is that you see you're able to accommodate it. You're not too small for your own life. Do you know what I mean? Like, suffering is not necessarily good. Suffering can make you bitter. But it's that you're able to, you're big enough for your life and your experience, and you can value it. And you can bear witness to it, your own and others' pain, and you can grow and you can learn from your own challenges. And when you look at its suffering, what is it actually? It might not be what you think it is. We don't give ourselves a chance, you know. We don't give ourselves a chance to be moved in this way. I always think, you know, there's this one teaching where they say, you know, if you have a bowl of soup and there's a stone in it, you don't have to throw out the whole soup. You just take out the stone you can still, like with a Dharma teacher who was talking about this, you can still eat the soup. So in the Dharma, if there's something you don't appreciate, just put it on hold for a while. Just take it out of the stone, and you can eat the rest of it. But, you know, I do think for myself, I really do genuinely believe the stone is the best part. The stone is the best part. Where you meet resistance, where you have difficulty, this is where things can really open up for you. So again, valuing things. Don't just shut down so easily. Give it a chance a little bit in that way. It's very important. Then what I also think happens from your practice is that what we grasp to as pleasurable can be most awakening when we give it away, as we've just discussed. So I feel that these two things give rise to a profound question. And the question is, what is happiness and suffering? Again, before we put a lid on it, before we decide what it is, before we try to subjugate it, before we try to embellish it, before it turns into this kind of belief so that we can't really see what it is. You know, this is where emptiness, you know, starts to come in. What is pain and what is pleasure? Sometimes you can't tell them apart. Sometimes things that you thought were very painful are the most awakening. Sometimes the things that you were so excited about actually have a lot of pain in them. Things start to equalize in a very interesting way. And I've talked to my teacher about this because I felt this was like the practice of one taste, Vajrayana practice of one taste. And he said, yeah, that's where it can lead. So that's why I say it feels like a Mahayana practice at first, but actually looking into this a little deeper, this is a very, very profound, deep practice of not being so afraid of your mind, not thinking that life is too big for you or too complicated or scary or beautiful or, you know, this is your life and you're big enough for your life. You're big enough for your life. You know, the main thing is how you value your life and use it to learn. And if you see it in this way, then you're not stuck. You're not stuck. You know, you're not stuck. Somehow, there's always something there for you. And you have the raw material you need. And life is very rich. That reminds me of recently I was in the car with my friend Ramjyoti, and she has this Volvo, and it's falling apart. And I said, Ramjyoti, how are you doing? And she says, what I heard was, like, life's a bitch. This is what I heard, because the motor was so loud. But actually, then I said, oh, yeah, life is kind of a bitch sometimes. And then she said, no, that's not it. I said, life is rich. And I thought, yeah, I'm much more happy to think in that way. That life is rich. This could be another title for the talk, you know, life is rich. You know, so just to get back to the kind of theme of this, Gina's question, kind of open question or ongoing question, what's it all for? You know, my feeling is, if I were to respond to that question for myself, it's to utilize, to wake up. To utilize, to wake up. So that's a lot of talking on my part. And what I thought, maybe we could just do a little bit of Tonglen. Is that okay? A little bit of Tonglen, and then we can move to Q&R.